Lord Tennyson one time spoke of some familiar ideas, staled by frequence, shrunk by usage into commonest commonplace. And I sometimes have the feeling that the Ten Commandments have become a set of ideas or symbol which is staled by frequence and shrunk by usage. Which we talk about but don't really look at, which we assume we understand without really understanding. I tenderly hear someone speak of the Ten Commandments in some such attitude such as this. Rabbi, I don't come around very much, but I try to obey the Ten Commandments, and that's what it's all about, isn't it? I usually mutter under my breath, Alavai, and I wonder what that person means when they say to me, I try to obey the Ten Commandments. Do they really mean it, or are they simply using the Ten Commandments as a convenient label, shorthand way of saying, well, I try and I do what I think I ought to do? I want this morning to expand your understanding of the Ten Commandments, to have you take a fresh look at them, and I tried to find the most unexpected way in which I could possibly introduce the Ten Commandments to you. And I decided that the best way to do so is to tell you about the champion liar in all of the Talmud, the most famous liar of all the sages of the Talmud. The very idea of associating lying and the sages of the Talmud seems inappropriate. But I speak this morning not of an ordinary garden variety kind of liar, the kind of person who sets out to deceive, a rather mean, selfish sort. I speak of a man for whom lying was an art, a professional liar. Now, the professional liars in the ancient world had a very honorable place in those communities. They were the professional storytellers, the tellers of tall tales. In the world, and there was a world, believe it or not, before television, in the world before television and 35-millimeter slides in the movies and easy jet travel, most people were perforce stay-at-homes. Travel was difficult, travel was slow, travel was dangerous. And only the few, the brave, the wanderer, those who suffered from wanderlust really traveled about. And if they were of an inventive mind and an agile tongue and could bring back from their travels tales of adventure and derring do, of wondrous things seen, they received a ready welcome. The community would flock to hear these tales. They would relieve the ordinariness and the drabness, the limitations of life. And so the traveler, who was also a storyteller, had an honorable place in the community. Everybody knew that he exaggerated a good bit, that he was a liar, but that was part of the game, part of the joy of it. Now, the champion professional storyteller among the sages of the Talmud is a man known as Rabba Bar Bar Hanna. He was born in the Sassanid Empire, what was called Babylon, in the 3rd century of this era. He received a fine rabbinic education. He went to the yeshiva at Sura. And then he decided to spend his junior year abroad. And he went west to the academies of Palestine, and there he spent some time in class, but more times going about. Every vacation he went somewhere. He was a dropout for a while. We know that he shipped out as a sailor on one of the tramp merchant ships of the day, and he went through the Mediterranean, through Gibraltar into the Atlantic. He joined a caravan that was going south through the Sinai to the Red Sea and into Saudi Arabia. Even joined a party of mountaineers bound for the high country of Anatolia. He traveled far, he saw much. He was of an able and agile tongue, he had an inventive mind, and when he came back, he paid for the rest of his education by being a professional storyteller. And he told some whoppers. And interestingly, so effective was his storytelling that it became famous. And the Talmud repeats in bare outline a number of these stories. And so when you read a very dull book on contract law in the Talmud called Baba Batra, when you come to about the 80th page of law, actually page 74 and 75, you find these pages filled with the tall tales of Rabba Bar Bar Hana. Once it seems he passed a shoreline on which a large whale had beached. Now, whales were unusual, and certainly in the highlands of Judea or along the lowlands of the Tigris River, nobody had ever seen a mammal of that sort. So when Rabba told of the beach whale, he said he'd seen this mammal thrown up on the beach. It was so vast in size that when it had been beached, it had destroyed, just rolled over 60 towns, destroyed every house in the town. And it was so big, he wanted them to know that the 60 towns had been able to supply all their food supply from the carcass of the whale for a whole year. And an enterprising merchantman in one of those towns had been able to extrude 300 barrels of oil from the whale's body. And then he'd happened to return along that coastline some months later, and the towns had all been rebuilt, and would you know it? They hadn't had to use wood as beams for their housing. The bones of the whale, the carcass, had provided all the beams that they needed for all the houses of the 60 towns. But the most interesting story of all that Rabba tells is a tale of an adventure in Sinai. I don't know if you recall the story in the book of Numbers, but when Moses was the leader of our people for those 40 years in the wilderness, he found the Jews as stiff-necked as every leader of Jews has ever found them. And they were constantly grumbling and mumbling and at times revolting and rebelling. One particular time, a major revolt was led by a man named Korach. Korach had a number of the notables of Israel among his colleagues. God was so angry at this revolt of the official class in Israel that he ordered the grounds to open up and to swallow up Korach and all of his company, and they went down living into Sheol. Now, when Rabba Bar Bar Hana went on this caravan into the Sinai, an Arab came up to him and said, "I can show you the cave into which Korach and all of his men were plunged. They're still there. You can hear them moaning." Of course, what Talmudic sage wouldn't go to see this great wonder? And so he went with the Bedouin, and they came to a crack, a fissure in the earth from which some hot gases were escaping. And Rabba took a long spear, and he took his handkerchief, he tied it to the point of his spear, and he let the spear with the handkerchief on it lower itself into the fissure. And when he pulled it back up, it was all cindered black from the fires of hell, and there was a sulfuric smell when he put it to his nostrils. And if you doubted Rabba, he had the handkerchief there to show it to you. But how do you know that it was Korach and his company of sinners who were in the cave? Well, Rabba had put his ear to the ground and heard the company moaning, Moshe v'torato emet v'hein badayin, that Moses and his Torah are true, and they were liars. Still, confession was going on these many hundreds of years later. And how could you doubt what a great Talmudic scholar told you? So obviously the tale was true. Now, what have the tall tales of Rabba Bar Bar Hana to do with the history of the Ten Commandments? Well, they got your attention. You're willing to listen, I hope, to the Ten Commandments. But more than this, Rabba was something more than simply a professional storyteller, a man who wandered here and there. He was a scholar, a rabbinic sage. He was particularly fascinated, as many of us still are, by the archaeology of our people, its ancient history. And one of the places that he visited most often from his school in the Galilee was Jerusalem, where 200 years earlier the great temple had stood, and where in the Messianic age the temple would stand again. And he walked over the Temple Mount, which now had a temple to Jupiter on the top of it. And he was told that here is the outline of the temple wall, and here is where the sacrifices were offered, and here is where the Devir, the Holy of Holies, stood. And he collected what he could of the tales of how the ceremony and the ritual of the temple had been organized, and he cherished these. And when he returned to Sura, to the great Babylonian academy, he became one of the resident experts in the way in which the temple had been organized, and therefore in the way in which Jewish worship would be reorganized when the Messiah came. But more than this, Rabba found that many of the old customs in the temple were very attractive, and he wanted to reintroduce some of these into the synagogue. And one particularly seemed attractive to him. And that was the idea, the fact, that as long as the temple stood, those who came to the temple for the morning sacrifice, for the Shacharit, had each morning recited publicly the Ten Commandments. The recitation of the Ten Commandments was once, during temple days, a routine daily feature of the worship of our people. And he asked the dean of Sura, why couldn't they at Sura reintroduce this very lovely custom of reciting the symbolic statement of the covenant, a synthesis of the first covenant between God and Israel as part of their worship. Now, the dean of this school was a man named Chista. Chista very patiently explained the reasons why the rabbis had not taken over this temple custom into the synagogue. He explained it in these words, Mipnei tar'omet haminim. We don't do this because of the misrepresentations of the minim. Now, min means heretic in Hebrew. In those days, in the first and second and third century, min referred particularly to all the brands of Christians, Judeo-Christians, Paulinian Christians, Gnostic Christians, who had emerged throughout the Near East. Somehow, the custom of not reciting the Ten Commandments here in the synagogue is associated with the misrepresentations, with certain misrepresentations about the Ten Commandments by Christians. Now, what were these misrepresentations? Well, Christianity, as you know, claims that its Messiah is prophesied in the Bible. And when the Bible speaks of a Messiah, they are predicting the coming of the Christ. And Christianity, as you know, looks at itself as possessing a New Testament which complements and supplements the Bible, which they call the Old Testament. Christianity prizes the wisdom of the Bible. It venerates the prophecy of the Bible because that prophecy is essential to the proof of the mission and holiness of the Christ. But it has a great deal of difficulty with the whole question of Torah, of law, of the very substantial rule which lies at the basis of the Bible and of Judaism. And early Christianity, claiming to cherish the Bible, having taken it unto itself because it is now the people, the true community of Israel, it cherishes Israel's scripture and the new scripture of Israel, did not know quite what to do with all of the commandments of the Torah. And so their sages made a division between the Ten Commandments and all the other commandments of the Torah. They said that the Ten Commandments represent natural law, the basic rule which any civilized community must have at its center in order to be peaceful, settled, and to have justice. And the rest of the commandments of the Torah are irrelevant. They have been superseded by the new covenant, the new dispensation, and the new rule which the church teaches. On Sinai, God gave to Moses 10 commandments. Somehow the Bible talks of other commandments not given on Sinai. These are of lesser worth, and they have now been superseded. And as a statement of the continuity of the New Testament with the Old, of the New Law with the Old Law, at the same time that it rejects the major part of the Old Law, the early church began to recite the Ten Commandments as a central feature of its worship. They recited it as a quintessence of the natural law. They avoided and voided all the other laws of the Torah. And we, Chista patiently explained to Rabba, we who accept the entire covenant, all of the 613 laws of the Torah, do not want to mislead our people by suggesting to them ceremonially or ritually that only the 10 are central, are significant. And so when a person says to me, I try to obey the 10 commandments, that's what it's all about, isn't it? I always have to say to him, no, that's not what Judaism is all about. The 10 commandments are part of the covenant. They are good and necessary, but not exhaustive. All of the laws the Bible establish, our calendar, our customs, our the further range of our civil and criminal law, all that makes Judaism distinctive, all these are part of our covenant with God, and they cannot be cavalierly tossed aside. Christianity tried to reduce Torah to the Ten Commandments. Judaism refused to do so. And so we voided the practice of reciting the Ten Commandments as part of our daily worship. And we put the Ten Commandments as a symbol, the two tablets of the law, above our ark. They stand there visibly as a symbol of the entire Torah behind the curtain within. They are never separate from the ark. They always stand near it, a way of reminding ourselves that it is the entire Torah that we venerate, and not simply these 10 fundamental, almost natural rules of human behavior. Judaism is something more than ethicism. Judaism is something more than a basic system of morality. It is a God-ordained way of life with a very special culture, with a very special calendar and ceremony, with a very special way. Now let's look further at these commandments, hopefully in an unexpected kind of way. We speak of 10 commandments. Do you know which are the 10 commandments? One of the interesting and unexpected facts which we discover when we read the two sections in the Bible where the 10 commandments are given is that neither in the preamble nor in the conclusion of these texts do they speak of 10 commandments. In the book of Exodus, which I read to you this morning, the text reads simply, "And you shall speak these words unto the children of Israel." And in the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 6, where the 10 commandments are repeated, the text reads simply, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinances and the judgments which I speak." There's no mention of 10. And there's a long-lasting debate in Christianity and in Judaism as to what the 10 are. In the Catholic Church, following the St. Augustine, the first commandment is not as it is in the beautiful incised set of tablets above the ark in our main temple. "I am the Lord thy God who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, Anochi Adonai." But the first commandment is, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." And the second commandment is, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image." The Christian, the Catholic Church, breaks what we call the second commandment into two parts. On the argument that what we call the first commandment, "I am the Lord thy God who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage," is not a commandment at all. It's a declaration by God of his nature. He is the God who redeemed Israel, who promises redemption to mankind. And there are other arguments as to the numbering of the 10 commandments. Whence the very idea of 10 commandments? We pile mystery on mystery. Only once in the Bible is the word 10 commandments, the phrase, used. When Solomon brings the Ark of the Law into his royal chapel in Jerusalem, the ceremony is described in the book of Kings at great length. There's the Ark, there are the tablets of stone in the Ark, but there's no mention of the Ten Commandments. The only time 10 is mentioned in reference to the commandments is in the 34th chapter of the book of Exodus, which purports to be a description of Moses' second ascent to Mount Sinai. You remember that he went up the first time and received the words. He wrote the words upon the tablet and he brought them down to the people. But in the meantime, The people had forsaken God and built for themselves a golden calf and danced in worship around that calf. And Moses was so angered by their perfidy and their disloyalty that he took the tablets and he shattered them. And after there's a reconciliation between Israel and God, with Moses as the mediator, God summons Moses back up to Mount Sinai, and he receives the tablets, the words, a second time. And at the conclusion of that chapter, chapter 34 of the book of Exodus, we are told, write down these commandments. And Moses wrote down on the tablets the terms of the covenant, the Aseret HaDvarim, the 10 words, the 10 commandments, as they had been given. Only there is the concept of 10 associated with the tablets of stone. Now, if we read the Bible critically, and not simply assuming that we know the story, we find that immediately preceding this particular text, there is a text which gives us 10 rules, 10 you shalls and you shall nots, which are very, very dissimilar to the familiar 10 commandments. In Exodus 34, there's a list of 10 commandments, which are by and large ceremonial in nature. You shall observe the Passover. You shall observe the Feast of Weeks. You shall observe the tabernacles, the Sukkot. You shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. You shall offer sacrifices unto me. You shall bring the first fruits of your fields, and so on. Now, this so-called cultic Ten Commandments seems to be the 10 rules which are referred to at the end of chapter 34, which has given scholars an infinite number of possibilities to speculate on. Some say that this 10 laws is really the primary 10 commandments, but when there were a rule of 10 which was more broadly ethical, more universal in nature, these became the central terms, the core terms of the covenant, and were written into the Sinai story. It seems more likely, however, that there were any number of lists of 10. It's an easy way of remembering a basic set of rules. You can count them on your fingers. And one of these was ethical, and one had to do with a calendar, was cultic, and there may have been others having to do with the sacrifices or the priestly responsibilities. Whatever the reason, we seem to have some indication here that the idea of 10 associated with our present text is in fact a displacement of an idea from one text to another. And that there were not, in fact, that the text which we call the Ten Commandments were not, in fact, a list of 10 commandments at all. And interestingly further, the Bible never uses the term 10 commandments. Even in Exodus 34, the text reads, Aseret HaDvarim, the 10 Dvarim. Now, in Hebrew, the word for commandment is mitzvah. And we might expect the term to be Aseret HaMitzvot, the 10 commandments, or Aseret HaChukim, the 10 laws, but not Aseret HaDvarim, the 10 words. The Bible speaks not of 10 commandments, but of 10 words of revelation, 10 statements of God's will, which is why the rabbis were prepared to accept the first commandment. I don't know quite how to refer to it otherwise. I am the Lord thy God who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, as number one in the list of the words. It is not a rule, but it is a self-revelation by God of his nature. Which is to say, that Judaism looks upon the Aseret HaDvarim, the 10 words or the 10 commandments, not as an exhaustive rule of do's and don'ts, but as a revelation by God of his will. And that revelation is both ethical and theological. That is, it deals both with do's and don'ts and with belief. It deals with belief in terms of redemption. I am the Lord thy God who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. I am the God who redeems. Religion deals with redemption and salvation, with promise and expectation, with messianic hope. And in the Ten Commandments, this hope, this promise, this salvation is implicit. God is the God who redeems, and God is the creative force of the universe. We observe the Sabbath not simply because everyone deserves a day of rest, not simply as a basic piece of labor legislation, but because God observed the Sabbath at creation. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath unto the Lord thy God. And then the text goes on to explain, because in 6 days the Lord created the heaven and earth, and he rested on the seventh day, wherefore the Lord blessed the seventh day and hallowed it. God is the creative force of the universe. God is the redemptive force within life, within history. These basic theological themes are affirmed by the Ten Commandments. So that the secularist of our day, who says to me, Rabbi, I don't come around much, I'm not very pious, but I try to observe the Ten Commandments, has in the first instance forgotten or never understood the basic religious dimension of these commandments. And in the second instance, he has robbed them of all of their specifically Jewish emphasis. He has taken away from the concept of Torah all that makes Judaism Jewish. The Ten Commandments are a symbol, not an exhaustive statement. They are a symbol of the faith and the rule of Jewish life. They are placed above the ark only, for within the ark is the exhaustive statement of our tradition. Let us not look at these commandments as if they are the be-all and the end-all of our faith. They establish the basic norms, yes, but there's so much more. And it's that so much more in terms of action, duty, in terms of faith and belief, which gives dimension, depth, and grace to our lives. Amen.